These rules aren't injunctions designed to make your life easier. They're actually injunctions designed to make your life more difficult. What I've done with these rules is they're very simple rules, and they're kind of comical and tongue-in-cheek in some ways. But what I've tried to do is pull them apart and show what's underneath them and to go down as deep as I possibly can. The first rule, which is kind of a comical rule, is stand up straight with your shoulders back. And it's a meditation, among other things, on the habits of lobsters. I read some papers on lobsters. I came across this finding that lobsters govern their postural flexion with serotonin. And I thought, God, that's so interesting. It's so into flexion is this, is to stand up straight. Okay? Wow, that's so interesting because, you know, depressed people crouch over. So how to present yourself? Because you want to present yourself to the world in a manner that doesn't disgrace you in some sense. That might be a good way to think about it. And you don't want to disgrace yourself because the consequence of disgrace is emotional dysregulation. More pain, less positive emotion. And so the best way to present yourself is to stand up forthrightly and to stretch out, you know, and to occupy some space. You make yourself sort of vulnerable by doing that because you open up the front of your body, right? But it's a sign of confidence. And that way people are most likely to give you the benefit of the doubt. And that's a good way to start regulating your mood. But not only does it directly regulate your mood to stand up, because postural flexion is associated with serotonin and emotional regulation, but also because if you straighten up and you present yourself in that manner, then other people are more likely to take you seriously. And that means they'll start treating you as if you're a number one lobster instead of a number 10 lobster. And that's another way that you can at least give yourself the bloody benefit of the doubt, right? And confront the world in a courageous manner. And that's a really good way of also of figuring out how to establish yourself in multiple competence hierarchies, because one of the general rules of thumb about how to be successful is to confront things that frighten you forthrightly and with courage. And that's kind of a universal strategy for success. And so that's what the verse chapter is about. So that's quite fun. Rule number two is treat yourself like you're someone that you care about. See, I read this piece of work by Jung a long while back, and it was a meditation on the injunction to treat your neighbor as you would like to be treated, something like that. And what Jung pointed out, which I really liked, was that wasn't an injunction to be nice to other people. It was an invitation to reciprocity. It was something like this. It's like, you should figure out how you would like to be treated, like you were taking care of yourself, not how you would like people to respond to you. It's more important than that. It's like, imagine you had a child that you really cared for, and someone said, well, people will treat this child exactly like you want them to, but you have to figure out what that is. And so then you'd have to sit down for like a month and you'd think, okay, well, how do you want your child to be treated? You don't want everyone just to be nice to him, you know. You want people to challenge him, and you want people to discipline him, and you want people to tell him when he's wrong. It's like, you don't just want everyone to be nice. That's pathetic. It's pathetic. There's no challenge in that. And so you want to treat other people like you would like to be treated. Well, then you have to figure out, how would you like to be treated? And while you'd like people to fawn all over you and just lay everything at your feet, it's like, no, that's not something you'd wish for someone that you were taking care of. Then there's an additional problem, which is it's often the case that people will treat other people better than they treat themselves. That happens extremely frequently. So one of the things I pointed out in chapter two was that if you have a dog and you take him to a vet and the vet gives you the prescription medicine, you'll go buy the medicine and you'll give it to the dog and you will do it properly. But if you go yourself to a doctor and you get a prescription, there's a 30% chance you won't even pick up the medication. And if you do, there's a 50% chance that you won't administer it to yourself properly. And so I really thought about that. When I first came across that statistic, it was another one of those little facts. And I thought, what the hell's up with that? It's like, you'll do it for your dog. So obviously you'll do it for something you care about, and you're conscientious enough so you'll actually do it. So like, why wouldn't you do it for you? Your dog likes you. You know, even your dog would rather that you did, but you don't. Why people don't like themselves very much. And I think there's two reasons really. And one is that we're fragile and damageable and imperfect in multiple dimensions all the time. And that often just gets worse. Lots of things get worse as you get old, for example. So it's not necessarily that easy for a self-conscious being who's extraordinarily aware of his or her own fragility, but not just fragility, foolishness and errors. Like, you know yourself better than anyone else knows you. And, you know, you might have a certain amount of dislike for someone you know because of something they did, but you know everything you did. It's a real existential question for people. It's like, why the hell should you take care of something as sorry and wretched as you are? And that's really what the chapter is about. It's because the answer in the chapter is, yeah, you know, you're First of all, yes, you're pretty useless and terrible, but so is everyone else. And that's actually an existential problem, right? And what I mean by that, it's a problem that every human being has always had and always will. So it's not just you. It's a universal problem. And there's an answer to that. And one of them is to, what is it to say? Love the sinner, but hate the sin. It's something like that, is that despite the fact that you're not all that you could be, the proper attitude to have towards yourself is the attitude that you would have towards someone that you genuinely cared for. And that it's incumbent on you to act as if you genuinely care for yourself, just like you would act towards someone that you actually cared about, some other person. So it's a reversal in some sense of the golden rule, right? Why you have a moral obligation to do that. It's not just that you should because it would be better for you. You actually have a moral obligation to do that, I think, because you make the world a much worse place if you don't take care of yourself. So you should bloody well take care of yourself, you know, because it's partly because you have something valuable to bring into the world. You have a light that you have to bring into the world. And that if you don't bring it into the world is a dimmer place. And that's a bad thing, because when the world is a dim place, it can get very, very, very dark. You need to take care of yourself because you're in the best position to do that. And it's necessary for you to take care of yourself, despite the fact that we're mortal and vulnerable and self-conscious and capable, not only capable of doing terrible things, but actually do them. Despite all that, you still have that responsibility. And the next rule is, make friends with people who want the best for you. And that's a meditation on my own childhood and adolescence to some degree. I had friends who wanted the best for me and friends who didn't. And, you know, they were friends who, some of them were aiming up and some of them were aiming down. And if you have a friend that's aiming down and you do something that's aiming up, then they're generally not that happy about it. You know, they try to top your accomplishment with one of their own hypothetical or real, or put down what you're doing, or offer you a cigarette if you're trying to quit and you've kind of done that successfully, or a drink if you've been drinking too much and are trying to stop being an alcoholic, you know. Or, yeah, they're cynical and bitter and devoted towards no good. And sometimes that's family members too. And sometimes it's even part of you, you know. But this chapter is an injunction to people, is like you have an ethical responsibility to take care of yourself, you have an ethical responsibility to surround yourself with people who have the courage and faith and wisdom to wish you well when you've done something good and to stop you when you're doing something destructive. And if your friends aren't like that, then they're not your friends. And maintaining your friendships with them might not even be in their interest. And so it's a tricky argument to make, because I'm not saying, you know, whenever anyone's in trouble, you should, you know, push them into a ditch and then give them a couple of kicks. That's not the idea. But I had a couple of rules I didn't write about. One was, be careful about whom you share good news with. And another was, be careful about whom you share bad news with. Those rules ring in people's minds quite quickly. A friend is someone you can share good news with, you know. You go to them and you say, hey, look, this good thing happened to me. And they say, look, I'm so happy that happened to you. Like, way to be. And they don't think, God damn it, why didn't that happen to me? And like, you know, you didn't deserve it. Here's a bunch of reasons you're stupid and why it won't work. It's like, that's not helpful. Well, that's chapter 3. Number 4 is, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. And the reason I wrote that was because there is inequality. What that means is there's always going to be people around that are better at something than you are. That's a problem, because you can get jealous and you can get bitter and you can get resentful. And worse, you can get hopeless. This friend of mine, he told me something so funny. He was decrying his lack of success in the world. And he compared himself to his roommate. And he said, you know, his college roommate was doing much better than he was. And his bloody roommate was Elon Musk. It's like, really? Like, it's like, oh, you're not doing as well as Elon Musk. I mean, you can see it would take it rather personally, because they were roommates and everything. It wasn't like he was doing badly. Like, he was doing pretty damn well. It's like, I'm not as good as Elon Musk. It's like, yeah, well, you and like 7 billion other people, you know. But I thought it was instructive, because you have to be careful who you compare yourself to. Now, you can't just not compare yourself to others, to successful people, right? Because then you don't have anything to aim at. You need an ideal, because you have nothing to aim at, but an ideal is a judge, and you always fall short of the ideal. So how the hell can you have the benefits of having an ideal without having the crushing blow that goes along with having the judge that always regards you as insufficient? Let's say you need a goal, but we don't want to let your distance from the goal crush you. So you got to set up a goal, and then you got to make the goal, break the goal down into parts so that you can move towards it. And you have a fairly high likelihood of doing it. It's some practical knowledge about how to go about achieving an aim. Set a high aim, but differentiate it down so you know what the next step is, and then make the next step difficult enough so you have to push yourself past where you are, but also provide yourself with a reasonable probability of success. It's also what you do with children. You want to push them because they need to grow up and be more than they are, right? But you don't want to crush them with constant failure. So what you do is aim high and make the goal difficult but proximate. And one of the things I've noticed that around 30, you really have to stop comparing yourself in some ways to other people. And the reason for that is that the particularities of your life are so idiosyncratic that there isn't anyone really all that much like you, you know, because the details of your life happen to matter. And so maybe you compare yourself to some rock star or something like that. And, you know, the person's rich and famous and glamorous and all that, but, you know, they're alcoholic and they use too much cocaine and they've had 3 divorces. And it's like, how the hell do you make sense out of that? Is that someone that you should judge yourself harshly against or not? The answer is you don't know, because you don't know all the details of their lives. And who do you know that you can compare yourself to? That's easy. You, yesterday. So here's a good goal. It's something like, well, aim high. And I really mean that. It's like, and we'll talk about that a little bit too. Aim high, but use as your control yourself. So your goal is to make today some tiny increment better than yesterday. And you can use better. You can define better yourself. This doesn't have to be some imposition of external morality. You know where you're weak and insufficient, where you could improve. Think, okay, well, this is what I'm like yesterday. If I did this little thing, things would be just an increment better. And that's a great thing, because you get the ball rolling, and incremental improvement is unstoppable. You can actually implement it, and it starts to generate Pareto distribution-like consequences. It starts to compound. Chapter 5, do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. You know, you have a natural affinity for children, and even more, maybe a more powerful natural affinity for your own children. So that's a good start. But you don't want to set them up as an enemy against you. You don't want to allow them to engage in the kind of hierarchical challenge that makes you irritable and resentful. That's not a good idea. And if the things they do make you dislike them, the probability that they will make other people dislike them is extraordinarily high. And so you can consult your own irritability. And the thing is, if you're good to your kid in the real way, you can help them maintain that tremendous attractiveness that they have as young children, and to respond to adults properly, like a puppy that wags its tail instead of growls and, you know, goes for your ankle. And then wherever they go, adults welcome them and teach them things and pat them on the head and smile at them genuinely, instead of saying, oh my God, here comes that couple with that goddamn brat again, you know, which is a horrible, that's a horrible thing to do to a child, because then everywhere they go, all the goodwill is false. You know, there's nothing that you can do to someone that's more terrible than to put them in a world where all the goodwill directed towards them is false. That's a terrible thing. Rule 6 is put your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. And that's not take no action for others until you have your act together. That isn't what the rule means. It means that bind your ambition with humility and work on what's right in front of you that you will suffer for if you get wrong before you engage in the large-scale transformation of other people. Rule 7, it's called do what is meaningful, not what is expedient. And I'll just tell you a little bit about the chapter, because I figured something out in it that, and then explained it, something that took me decades to figure out. So it's a very deep Christian idea that the Messiah is the person who takes the world's sins upon himself, right? That's a characteristic of Christ, right? It's something, the idea is something like Christ died for your sins. It's like, what the hell does that mean exactly? You know, and partly what it means, and I would say a slightly corrupted form of Christianity, is that you just have to believe that that happened and you're redeemed. The idea that the Savior is the person who takes the world's sins upon himself is exactly that. It's exactly the same idea. The way that there stops being Nazis is for you to know that the Nazis were you, and for you to decide not to do that. But you have to know, you see, this is the thing that people won't do. You have to understand that you could not only do what the Nazi camp guards did in Auschwitz, but that you could actually enjoy it. And then you have to decide that you're not going to do that anymore. And that's not an easy thing to figure out. So that's a rough chapter, man. That's a rough chapter. And that's only a bit of what it's about. You know, there's a lot in there. Rule 8, which is tell the truth, or at least don't lie, is a necessary conjunction to that, or a necessary additional element, because I don't think that you can pursue what is meaningful without telling the truth. And the reason for that is if you don't tell the truth, or let's say if you lie, which is an easier way to think about it, you corrupt the mechanisms, the instinctual mechanisms that manifest themselves as meaning, and then you can't trust them. And that's a very bad idea. So the fundamental reason to not lie is because you corrupt your own perceptions if you lie. And when you corrupt your own perceptions, then you can't rely on yourself. And if you can't rely on yourself, then, well, good luck to you. Because what are you going to rely on in the absence of your own judgment? You've got nothing if you lose that. Chapter 9 is assume that the person you are listening to might know something you don't. This is a chapter about conversation and about the different forms conversation takes. And it's a chapter about humility, and it's a chapter about listening. And the humility element is, it took me a long time to understand why there's religious injunctions supporting humility. To even understand what the word really meant in that sort of technical sense, and it means something like this. It means what you don't know is more important than what you know. Then what you don't know can start to be your friend, you see. People are very defensive about what they know. But the thing is, you don't know enough. And the you can tell you don't know enough because your life is not what it could be, and neither is the life of the people around you. You just don't know enough. And so what that means is that every time you encounter some evidence that you're ignorant, someone points it out, you should be happy about that because you think, oh, you just told me how I'm wrong. It's like, great. Like maybe I had to sift through a lot of nonsense to get through the real message that you're telling me, but if you could actually tell me some way that I'm wrong, and then maybe give me a hint about how to not be wrong like that, well, then I wouldn't have to be wrong like that anymore. That would be a good thing. You can embark on that adventure by listening to people. And if you listen to people, they'll tell you amazing things if you listen to them. And many of those things are little tools that you can put in your toolkit, like Batman, and then you can go out into the world and use those tools, and you don't have to fall blindly into a pit quite as often. And so the humility element is, well, do you want to be right or do you want to be learning? And then it's deeper than that. It's, do you want to be the tyrannical king who's already got everything figured out? Or do you want to be the continually transforming hero, or fool for that matter, who's getting better all the time? And that's actually a choice, you know? It's a deep choice. And it's better to be the self-transforming fool who's humble enough to make friends with what he or she doesn't know and to listen when people talk. And listening is a transformative exercise. Like if you listen to the people in your life, for example, if you actually listen to them, they'll tell you what's wrong with them and how to fix it and what they want. They can't even help it if you start listening, because people are so shocked if you actually listen to them that they tell you all those sorts of things that they might not have even intended to, things they don't even know. And then you can work with that. The listening will straighten them out, because people think by talking. And in order to think, you have to have someone to listen, because I mean, it's very hard to think. Hardly anyone can think. And even the people who can think can only think about a limited number of things. But almost everybody can talk. And you can listen to yourself talk. And if someone listens to you, then you also have a foil for your thoughts, right? Because you can watch the person when you're talking and see if you're boring or see if you're amusing or if you're engrossing, all of those things. And so listen, that's a very good thing. Rule 10 is be precise in your speech. That's an observation, I would say, that a variant of a New Testament injunction, which is, or maybe a description of the nature of the world, which is knock and the door will open and ask and you will receive, which is a very strange theory, let's say, but which I would say is far more in accordance with what we know about the psychology of perception, let's say, than you might imagine, because it is the case that you don't get what you don't aim at. You might get what you do aim at. And your aim might get better as you aim as well, which is something to consider. Actually, if you specify the nature of the being that you want to bring into being, then you radically increase the probability that that's what will occur. And of course, you all know that because you regard yourself, at least to some degree, as active creative agents, right? Your fundamental attitude towards yourself, at least in the manner that you act towards yourself, is that you wake up in the morning and you have a landscape of possibilities that lay themselves open to you, and you make choices between those possibilities and determine in consequence how the world is going to manifest itself. So you confront a field of potential, that's a good way of thinking about it, and through your choices you determine which elements of that potential are going to concretize themselves into the real world. And you are very unhappy with yourself if you don't do that properly, and you're very unhappy with other people if they don't do that properly, and you're very unhappy with other people if they don't treat you like that's what you're like. Because part of what you demand from people, let's say, in terms of sheer civility, is that they act towards you as if you're the locus of voluntary choice in a world of potential. And you upbraid each other for that as well. If you have children and parents, your parents will say to you, if you're fortunate, you're not living up to your potential. which is actually a compliment in a sense, even though it's also a judgment. And the compliment is, I know perfectly well that you could be more than you are. And you'll hang your head if you have any sense, and you'll think, like you think in relationship to your own conscience, that yes, I have a lot of potential that I'm not fully realizing, and that actually constitutes a transgression against the good. And I don't think I've ever met anyone who doesn't believe that. If you have a reasonable conversation with them, it just seems self-evident. I mean, maybe now and then you meet someone who's narcissistically self-satisfied, but then they're narcissistic, and that's not good. That as a medium to long-term strategy, that's a catastrophe. That ends in disaster. You know, it's a short-term, it protects people, but long-term, it's not good in the least. And of course, other people don't appreciate it as well. Rule 11 is don't bother children when they're skateboarding. And that's actually a discussion of courage, of encouragement. More specifically, you also want to encourage them, which is not the same as sheltering them. It's not the same at all. And to encourage someone is to say something like, or to act out something like, look, kid, the world's already difficult, because the world isn't easy for children any more than it's easy for adults. The difficulties are, they're not the same. They're child-sized difficulties, but they're still difficulties. The world is a very hard place, and it's a bitter place in many ways. And it's not only a hard and bitter place, it's also touched with betrayal and malevolence. And that's the fundamental bottom line. But there's something in you that is capable of taking that full on and transcending it. And that's encouragement. You say, well, as difficult as things are, you're up to the challenge. And to interfere with children when they're skateboarding, for example, when they're doing, let's say, inadvisably dangerous things, which kids, of course, do if they're skateboarding, to interfere with that is to interfere with the child's willingness to voluntarily expose themselves to the risks that they need to expose themselves to in order to develop the sort of competence that allows them to thrive in a world they cannot be sheltered from. And so to interfere with children when they're taking necessary risks is not love or empathy, but cowardice on the part of parents. And it's deeply damaging to children. Final rule, pet a cat when you encounter one on the street. You're overwhelmed by crisis as you shorten your time frame. You know, it's like you can't think about next month. Maybe you can't even bloody well think about next week, or maybe not even tomorrow, you know, because now is just so overwhelming that that's all there is. It's like, and that's what you do. You cut your time frame back until you can cope with it. And if it's not the next week that you see how to get through, then it's the next day. And if it's not the next day, then it's the next hour. And if it's not the next hour, then it's the next minute. And you know, people are very, very, very tough. And it turns out that if you face things that you can put up with a lot more than you think you can put up with, and you can do it without becoming corrupted. You have to be alert when you're suffering. You have to be alert to the beauty in life, the unexpected beauty in life. And that's kind of what I was trying to get across with the idea of the cat. There's this cat that lives across the street from us called Ginger, and Ginger's a Siamese cat. And cats really aren't domesticated, eh? Technically speaking, they're still wild animals, but they kind of like people. God only knows why, but they do, you know? And so Ginger will come wandering over, and our dog looks at her, but they're friends, and she rolls over on his back, and Seiko used to, you know, nose her a bit, and then she kind of mosey over and let you pet her if she was feeling like it that day. And, you know, you have to look for those little bit of that little bit of sparkling crystal in the darkness when things are bad. You have to look and see where things are still beautiful and where there's still something that's sustaining. And, you know, you narrow your time frame and you'd be grateful for what you have, and that can get you through some very dark times, and maybe even successfully if you're lucky. But even if unsuccessfully, then maybe it's only tragic and not absolute hell. If we didn't all attempt to make terrible things even worse than they are, then maybe we could tolerate the terrible things that we have to put up with in order to exist, and maybe we could make the world into a better place, you know? And it's what we should be doing and what we could be doing, because we don't have anything better to do. And that's the end of 12 Rules for Life.